It's a scenario that's almost a cliche at this point, but I think only because it's so painfully common. You, or maybe someone you know, has that standing appointment. Every Tuesday, 4 p.m., you drive there, you sit on the beige couch and you talk.
You unpack the week.
Right. You dig up some old memories, maybe about your parents, and you leave feeling, I don't know, vented, a bit lighter, maybe.
But then Wednesday
And the
comes.
anxiety is still there, the trigger is still hot, you're doing the work. But the work never seems to actually be
And
done.
that is the great frustration of modern mental health for so many. The goal has kind of shifted from actual healing to just management. We're taught to cope with our trauma, to build strategies, to live around the pain.
Yeah, it's like having a broken leg and being told, well, we can't fix the bone, but here's a really expensive high-tech crutch.
Exactly.
But then you hear these other stories, the outliers, people with like capital T, trauma, PTSD, deep phobias, and they go do something that sounds kind of weird for a few sessions.
Right, they're waving their hands around or visualizing something.
And suddenly the problem is just gone,
Yeah.
not managed, deleted.
And that is exactly where we're diving today. This isn't magic,
Yeah.
and it's not the placebo effect. We are looking at the biology of how the brain can actually rewrite itself.
Okay.
We're pulling from the research and writings of a psychotherapist named Clint Matheny, specifically his work on how effective psychotherapy works. To really understand this core mechanism of memory reconsolidation.
Memory reconsolidation. Okay, that sounds like a hard drive utility function.
It kind of is for your brain.
So before we get into the how, we should probably set the stage on the what, because I think most of us have a basic misunderstanding of what a memory even is. We think of it like a video file, stored in a vault.
That was the scientific dogma for most of the 20th century. The idea was you have a short-term memory, which is fragile, and then the brain does some chemical work protein synthesis and locks it down. That's consolidation.
And once it's consolidated, it's permanent.
It was believed to be permanent,
Yeah.
hard-coded, indestructible. You could take the file off the shelf, look at it, and put it back, but you couldn't change the ink on the page.
But that model's not right.
Not at all.
Yeah.
In the early 2000s, that model was shattered. Researchers Karim Nader and Joseph Ledoux, they did these groundbreaking experiments with rats,
Okay.
and they proved something incredible. When you recall a long-term memory, it doesn't just play back. For a brief period, the chemical glue holding it together actually dissolves.
It dissolves.
The memory becomes labile or unstable. It turns back into a malleable draft again.
So, just by remembering something, I am physically unlocking the file for editing.
Yes, but, and this is the absolute key, you're on a
A
timer.
dimer.
It's called the reconsolidation window. Once that memory is destabilized, you have about 4 to 6 hours before the brain naturally locks it back down again.
4 to 6 hours, that's a very specific biological window.
It is. And Matheny's whole argument is that every therapy that has ever permanently cured something,
Yeah.
it worked because it accidentally or intentionally hit this exact mechanism within that window.
So memory reconsolidation isn't a type of therapy. It's
Yeah.
the engine. It's the combustion that makes the car move, and all the different therapy brands are just different ways of turning the key.
Precisely. And if you do it right, you don't just feel better for a week. You strip the emotional charge from the memory. The fact remains, but the pain, the fear,
Yeah.
it's gone.
That sounds incredible, but if it's just a matter of remembering things, why aren't we all cured? I mean, I have looped my most embarrassing moments in my head 1,000 times. I've definitely reactivated them.
And this is where it gets technical. This is where most therapy and our own self-reflection fails. Matheny lays out a very specific three-step formula. You were doing step one,
Yeah.
reactivation. But just recalling it isn't enough. You have to feel it, talking about it intellectually from your logical brain. That doesn't open the window. You have to feel the tightness in your chest, the heat in your face. The synapse has to be firing.
Okay, that makes sense. You have to bring the file up on the screen to edit it. But I've done that too. I've had moments of deep, visceral shame or fear where I was definitely feeling it, and it usually just makes me feel worse.
And that's the danger. If you only do step one without step two, you're just reinforcing the trauma. You're deepening that neural groove.
So what's step two?
Step two is the critical, often missing piece, the mismatch.
The mismatch. Okay, what is that?
It's a neuroscience concept called prediction error. Your brain is a prediction machine. It's trying to keep you alive based on past data. So if a dog attacked you, your brain predicts dog equals danger.
Survival 101.
To rewrite that memory, you have to violate that prediction while the memory is active. You need to be feeling the fear of the dog but simultaneously experiencing something that flatly contradicts it.
So I have to feel the fear and the safety at the exact same time.
Exactly. Simultaneous.
Yeah.
That clash creates the prediction error. The brain goes, wait a minute, I'm predicting massive danger, but I'm currently experiencing safety. This old file is inaccurate. I need to update it.
Wow. That sounds incredibly difficult to pull off.
It's nuanced.
Yeah.
And this is why Matheny is so critical of therapies like prolonged exposure or PE.
That's where they have you retell the trauma story over and over.
Yes, sometimes 10 or 15 times with the theory that you'll get used to it. But he points out the dropout rates for PE are really high. Because if you just reactivate step one without a clear mismatch, step two, you are re-traumatizing yourself.
You're just hitting save on the fear file over and over.
Correct. But if you get that mismatch right, that aha moment, then step three happens automatically. Re-encoding. The brain overwrites the old memory. The emotional root is just severed.
Okay, so the formula is, one, feel the bad thing. Two, experience something that proves the bad thing is wrong right now. Three, the brain updates itself.
That's it.
It sounds so simple on paper, but then you look for a therapist and it's just this. Alphabet soup. CBT, DBT, EMDR, IFS. Matheny has a strong take on this, doesn't he?
He does. He calls it the technique trap.
Mm-hmm.
His view is different doors, same house. All of them, if they actually work permanently, are just clever ways of getting into the house of memory reconsolidation.
Even the really weird ones, like EMDR, where you're following a pen with your eyes.
Especially the weird ones. Think about EMDR. You hold the traumatic memory in your mind. That's reactivate.
Step one.
At the same time, you're forced to focus on the therapist's finger moving back and forth. That's a dual attention task.
Mm-hmm.
The weirdness of the eye movement, plus the safety of the office, creates the mismatch.
So you can't get totally lost in the trauma because your eyes are busy doing this other thing in the present moment.
Exactly. The brain predicts, I'm going to be completely overwhelmed by this memory. But the eye movement keeps you grounded. So the brain registers, huh, I'm remembering it, but I'm not overwhelmed. Prediction error. Update.
And what about something like RTM reconsolidation of traumatic memories? That one sounds like they just named the therapy after the mechanism.
They basically did. With RTM, they might have you imagine sitting in a movie theater projection booth watching your trauma on a black and white screen.
Ah, so the distance creates the mismatch. I'm seeing the horror, but I'm safe up here in the booth.
Yes. And Matheny is quick to point out that none of this is actually new. He looks back at Milton Erickson, the famous hypnotherapist from the mid-20th century.
Oh, the guy who did all the really unconventional stuff.
He was a wizard. He was doing this stuff instinctively, decades before the neuroscience caught up. He was a master of the mismatch. He'd use confusion or shock or absurd metaphors to completely derail a patient's rigid thinking. He knew that to change a mind, you first have to surprise it.
But now, instead of wizards, we have corporations. Matheny seems pretty frustrated with the gatekeeping of all this.
That's the political side of his critique. He points out that protocols like RTM are being trademarked. People are trying to own the cure.
Which is crazy.
His argument is that memory reconsolidation is a biological reflex. You can't trademark it any more than you can trademark sneezing. And it hurts patients because insurance will cover standard talk therapy, which is often about coping. But they deny the so-called experimental methods that might actually be fixing the problem.
Speaking of methods that sound, well, a bit out there, we have to talk about Matheny's favorite. It's called clean language.
Yes.
And I'll be honest, when I first read about this, it sounded completely woo-woo. It involves talking to metaphors.
It does sound that way.
Yeah.
But the logic is actually very neurologically sound. The idea is that your emotional subcortical brain, it doesn't speak English. It speaks in symbols.
Like in dreams.
Exactly like in dreams. Mm. Your brain's native language. Clean language tries to speak that language directly.
She gives this one case study that's just staggering. A client with major long-term depression.
Right. So a typical therapist might ask, why are you depressed? But that leads to an intellectual story. Instead, this therapist asks, and whereabouts is this depression?
A GPS location in the body.
That's step one, reactivate. Mm. You have to feel it to locate it. And the client said, it's a dark cloud inside my head.
A dark cloud. Okay, my cynical brain would immediately want to say, okay, that's a nice metaphor, but let's talk about your childhood.
And that would shut the whole process down. Instead, the therapist stayed in the metaphor, treated the cloud as if it were real. And then came the genius move for the mismatch.
Yeah.
He asked the cloud a question. He asked, and what would that dark cloud like to have happen?
He treated the symptom like it had its own agency.
Yes. And think about the prediction error there. The brain expects depression to be a dead weight, a permanent stuck object. By asking what it wants, you introduce the possibility of movement, of change. You violate the prediction of stuckness.
And what did the cloud want?
The client paused for a moment and said, it wants to float up.
Just float up.
That was the answer. And as the client said it, they visualized it. The cloud floating up out of their head and drifting away.
You're telling me that imagining a cloud floating away cured clinical depression?
It sounds absurd on the surface, but look at the mechanism. The dark cloud was the neural representation of the trauma. The floating up was the mismatch and the re-encoding. The brain updated the file from permanent weight to temporary cloud that left.
Did it stick, though? I mean, I can see feeling better for an hour, but...
Matheny cites a 29-year follow-up.
29 years.
The depression never came back. The root was gone. There was no program left to run.
That is just, it's mind-blowing. It implies our deepest struggles might be held in place by something as fragile as a metaphor.
And if you change the metaphor, you change the mind. But this brings up a huge catch, and this is where we get into the controversy around medication.
The meds versus feeling debate. And we should be really clear here. We are not telling anyone to stop taking their medication.
Absolutely not. Meds are often crucial for crisis stabilization. But Matheny brings up a difficult biological reality. His phrase is, you can't heal what you can't feel.
That's a tough pill to swallow, no pun intended. What's the interference?
Well, think about what these drugs do. They're designed to buffer emotional extremes. They chemically dampen the system so you don't feel the sharp edges of panic or despair.
They turn the volume down.
Exactly. But remember step one, reactivate. To open that reconsolidation window, you need to fully activate the circuit. If the medication is acting as a chemical buffer, you might just be unable to reach the threshold needed to destabilize the memory.
So you can go to therapy, talk about the trauma, but because the meds are keeping you calm, you never actually open the file to edit it.
That's the risk. You end up in a state of permanent management. You're comfortable, maybe, but you're not cured. It's a real paradox for patients.
I need the meds to function, but the meds might be preventing me from ever not needing the meds.
It's a tough spot.
Hmm.
And it suggests that the goal should be using medication as a temporary bridge to stability so you can then do this deeper transformative work.
It really reframes the whole idea of mental illness. We've come to see it as a chronic condition, like diabetes. But this science suggests that for many things, PTSD, phobias, grief, it might be more like a broken bone. It can heal.
That's the entire shift. Moving from an era of containment, keeping the demons in a cage, to an era of transformation, realizing the demons are just old data files that can be overwritten.
So to bring us back to you, the learner, you might not have PTSD or a dark cloud, but we all have our stuff, right? That one criticism that always stings, or that irrational fear, or that defensive reaction we have?
Absolutely. This mechanism is universal. That flash of anger you feel, that's a memory file firing, that sudden urge to shut down, that's a prediction of danger based on your past.
And the takeaway here is that those responses, they aren't you. They aren't your fixed personality.
No, they're just recordings. And recordings can be taped over. You just have to find a way to hit that mismatch button.
It's kind of a destabilizing thought, isn't it? We get so attached to our traumas as part of our identity. I am an anxious person.
The identity trap. But if that anxiety is just a biological circuit waiting for a mismatch, then who are you on the other side of the rewrite?
And that's the question I think we'll leave you with today. If your deepest emotional scars, the things you think define you, are just unstable biological data waiting for a mismatch, how much of your current personality is actually permanent? And how much of it is just one good realization away from disappearing forever?
Makes you wonder how much of your potential is just locked behind old files waiting for the right password.
It certainly does. Thanks for taking this deep dive with us.
My pleasure.